Welcome. We're going to talk tonight about an aspect of Shabbat that I think is very central and very important. I think it's one that people encounter no matter what direction it is they come to Shabbat. It's a category often called colloquially muktzah. And this is a category that those who grow up with an intensive regime of Shabbat observance know from a very young age, often associate with the most neurotic aspects of Shabbat, where it's like, don't touch that! That's muktzah! Don't touch that! The notion that you don't go near certain things even if you don't do anything with them. And for those who come to Shabbat observance later, this is something many people have told me. They like, you know, they show up to college and like there's all these people like talking about muktzah and like you can't touch this, and they're like, what are you talking about? And it's a sort of very jarring thing that's both very central but capable of being absent in a consciousness of Shabbat that you might otherwise have had. And I actually want to explore that tonight, both why it's so central and also how it can become so peripheral. That's part of what we're going to look at. So with that, let's jump right in here. In the Torah, and we're going to have a little bit for those, you know, who are familiar with the format we often use here, it's going to be a little bit of a longer introduction before we get to the Chavruta piece, and then we're going to go upstairs, and then we'll come back together to wrap things up. Okay, but instead of like a 5-minute intro, it's going to be more like a 20-minute intro. Okay, so in the Torah, and for right now, you can look on with someone next to you while we're, you know, running off more copies. In the Torah, there's a lot of talk about milacha, about the actual forbidden activity that the Torah says you're not supposed to do. But really, as centrally, there are passages that talk very clearly about what it means to have everything ready before Shabbat. That is to say, rather than thinking about Shabbat as focusing solely on action, to think about Shabbat also as focusing on what does it mean to slip into this time period and to only have crossed the boundary with you those things that are, to use the early rabbinic terminology, muchanim, that have been kind of prepared, made ready, in a sense that they can come across the boundary with you and everything else gets left with the rest of the world on Friday afternoon. I think we need, there's a couple also over here. You can see this in a number of pre-rabbinic texts that I brought here before we get to them. This notion of not engaging with things that have not been specifically prepared for Shabbat, if you start to think about it, is potentially incredibly vast. It potentially takes you to a place where the only thing you do on Shabbat is eat the food you got ready before Shabbat, pray to God, and pretty much don't touch or engage with anything else materially. Right? And I want you to, it's far from where our conception of Shabbat for most people has gotten to, and so I want you just to kind of, you have to enter into that headspace of imagining a world where actually your goal is, what I have as a subtitle here, right, withdrawing from God's world. If you think in a very literal sense about one of the justifications for Shabbat being that God created the world in 6 days and then withdrew, stopped. One of the real most, you know, imitative ways of God that one could respond to that narrative would be to simply withdraw from the world. Not just to not do hard work and labor and all that stuff, but actually to say, I don't really touch the world the same way God left the world the way it was, except for perhaps the most basic functions. And so that includes all sorts of restrictions, like not touching rocks and sticks and all sorts of things that are just part of the raw, unprocessed natural world, and also can potentially extend to not touching markers, computers, potentially even pieces of paper that I have no real use for, potentially kitchen utensils that I have no use for, really potentially anything that would be involved, that would involve any kind of creative activity, saying, what do you need to go near those things on Shabbat? And just to give you a sense of the world in which that plays out, I brought you here a few sources in this section A, what I call the prehistory of moving Kelim on Shabbat. Now, I left Kelim untranslated because it has a lot of different meanings. It's often used to mean, it's often translated as utensils, I think only Jews who study Hilchot Shabbat use the word utensils to mean anything beyond fork, knife, and spoon for the most part. But that is a common way it is translated. Tools is a translation I've used later on in a number of places, and that in some ways is more accurate. A kli, suffice it to say, is something you kind of use to do something with. Food is not a kli. A cup is. A spoon is. A computer is. Anything that's kind of been fashioned by human hands that has some kind of purpose. So look at the way these early sources, pre-rabbinic sources, deal with touching things, even kelim, right? Even things that have already been somewhat processed on Shabbat. Someone want to read us the Damascus document here? First source? Go for it.
No man shall eat on the Sabbath day except that which is already prepared. He shall eat nothing lying in the fields. He shall not drink except in the camp. If he is on a journey and goes down to bathe, he shall drink where he stands, but he shall not draw water into a vessel. He shall not raise his hand to strike his animal with his fist. If it is stubborn, he shall not take it out of his house. He shall neither lift stone nor dust in his dwelling. But should any man fall into water or fire, let him not be pulled out with the aid of a ladder or rope or some such utensil.
Okay, so you see here, this text starts off with talking about preparations. Things that are already mukhanim, that are already, you know, in some way made ready, and even food, if it hasn't been gathered and prepared, is deemed out of bounds on Shabbat. Right? You cannot go to a river, according to this text, and go and bend over and take a drink from the river. Because that water is basically a raw part of God's world, and unless you drew it with a bucket before Shabbat and brought it into the camp, into your house, you can't partake of that. But then, even more shockingly, after talking about some of these categories we talked about, not touching rocks and earth, not touching animals, another category of things that you should be laying off of, you get even to this shocking piece at the end, that even if someone is in danger, they've fallen into water or fire, they cannot be pulled out with the use of a kli, of a utensil. Now, aside from the fact this text is very interesting on the question of Pikuach Nefesh and whether saving a life supersedes Shabbat, and this text does not seem to go the direction that rabbinic sources go. But that only underscores the thing that they don't want to override, which is picking up a ladder. Okay, I want you to understand, the reason I bring you this source is so you get sort of as a background here that picking up a ladder was considered to be, in this pre-rabbinic world, such a serious offense that you would potentially even forego saving someone's life in order to stay true to that. And you can see this in the next source, which is a fragment from Qumran that plays this out further, where it says, if a man falls into water on the Sabbath day, he shall pass to him his garment to lift him out, but he shall not carry an instrument to lift him out on the Sabbath day. So you see there, it's not about the lifting the person out. It's about the thing you use to lift them out. And a piece of clothing is okay, considered to be basically a basic part of the body, but something that is not something a person would wear, you can't use to lift the person out. All right, so that background is going to be just important for filling in the picture. Yeah?
In the case of carrying an instrument, I can imagine kind of two things. One, you're carrying, but two, you've prepared it in advance, which actually seems in line with some of the other things that you're saying. If you know you're going to be in a situation where you'll need food or you'll need, in this case, an instrument, why would that pose a problem?
So I think you have to understand here, these sources don't totally play this out, but I think you have to understand it as what you articulated as, if the instrument has already been prepared, has already sort of entered the human domain before Shabbat, is the way rabbinic texts are going to end up thinking about kelim. But the starting point I think you have to understand as, the default position is you don't touch things on Shabbat. And what do you need to go near a ladder? And if you don't assume that saving a life overrides Shabbat, then I'm not justified going near a ladder. Right? The only thing basically I'm justified going near is food and drink, and presumably, and we'll see this in rabbinic sources, the basic tools I would need to eat those. But outside of that, I have no business going near anything. Yeah?
I was just wondering if the word here, translation, so you're using vessel, right, you're using utensil, you're using instrument, is it all kli?
In all those cases, I believe it's kli. It's different. Yeah, both of those are vermes. So I have to go back and check it. Josephus, I don't remember what it is in the Greek. Right? So there's not. He's not using kli. He's using some other term.
I was just wondering if this is talking about something.
Are they making any kind of?
Or is it about like a general conceptual thing about using a tool in some like more broad sense.
Right. I have to go back and check what all the how all the words would line up there. Okay? Now, Josephus, just the last thing here, when he's describing these scenes, you'll say, he says, oh, they're stricter than any of the other Jews, resting from their labors on the seventh day. They not only get their food ready the day before, so they don't have to light a fire, but they will not remove any vessel out of its place, nor go to stool thereon. Okay, so forget about the challenges of going to the bathroom for the Essenes. You've got here a notion that picking an object up, this thing is lying here, and I pick it up and I move it to somewhere else, that is, for the Essenes, a core violation of Shabbat. Okay? That's part of what it means to observe Shabbat, is not to move those things around. Yeah?
In the second, the Qumran thing?
Yeah.
You said that the garment is considered part of the body.
That's my my attempt to understand why that would be different. Like, why do they treat the garment?
Not, derech hatzalah is not through, like, you know.
Maybe. I might say something different, though, which is that the garment is not really used to do anything with. It's something that you wear. And what they may be saying is, it's not that anything fabricated is a problem. It's that the problem is using something that is intended to have some kind of active effect on the world. Whereas a garment is just used to clothe human beings. And that sense poses less of a problem. But it's speculative. It's hard to know. Okay. So now I want to look quickly at the two core rabbinic texts that kick off our discussion. Then we'll look briefly at a couple quick exceptions to those texts and set you off learning the passage from the Gemara that we'll focus on tonight. Okay? So someone want to take Tosefta Shabbat 14:1. Yeah.
Right. At first, they used to say that only three tools could be moved on Shabbat. A knife to chop pressed dates, a soup ladle, and a small table knife. They added more and more to this list until they said, all tools may be moved on Shabbat except for the large saw used to cut wood and the pin of a plow. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, except for the ship's anchor as well. Rabbi Yossi says, except for the large spade as well. Rabbi Nehemiah says, even a cloak or a ladle may only be moved with tzorah for a specific purpose need.
Right, that's my translation on the tzorah, but we're going to come back to that in a second. All right, so what do you see here? At the beginning, in the first stage, what are you allowed to move?
Eating utensils.
The most basic things you need to eat. You can't eat the nuts without, you can't eat the figs without having something to tear them apart. So you're entitled to use that. You can't eat soup by just picking up the pot and pouring it into your mouth. So you have to be able to use a ladle. And there's certain foods that you need to cut before you put them in your mouth. So you're entitled to a small table knife. But other than that, what do you need to touch anything for? Right, this very much fits into that culture. This is it's a great example where a rabbinic text talking about Barishona, the way it used to be, actually basically exactly matches what we have in pre-rabbinic sources. Okay? So it lays that out. Those are the three things. And then we have this mysterious process. We're not told why. They start permitting more and more stuff. Right? Something is happening with the culture of Shabbat where that taboo on touching utensils and moving utensils is breaking down. Yeah.
Can I ask a background question?
Please.
I've kind of lost the predicate for all of Muktzah, right? Like, usually when you learn Shabbos, there's kind of some asmachta. Maybe it has to do with, building the Mishkan. And you didn't bring one here. So I'm curious where the first instance of this, of these limitations, where we see it.
Right. Where does it even come from? So, right, if we were doing this fully thoroughly, I would give you the story about the man, where it talks about v'hechinu et asher yaviu, they're supposed to have everything ready the day before, which is one source. I might also bring you the story of the mikoshesh etzim, the wood gatherer, who seems like, what's he doing that's so bad on a melacha level, like he's just picking up sticks. But if you read free of a melacha lens, it actually seems the problem is he's picking up sticks, and he shouldn't be picking up sticks on Shabbat, not that he's about to burn them, and he may be about to do all those things, but the problem was that itself, not that he lit a fire. In short, it's not like it says, like you can point to sort of a verse that says it, flat out, but those are the two best examples, I think, of where you would hook it. But what is clear is that early rabbinic sources take for granted, as you see in this text, this is part of what they inherit, right? Part of their understanding of the Torah that they inherit is this. Okay? Now, just hold your question for 1 second. So, they start adding more and more and more. We're not going to talk about the exceptions, the big saw and the pin of the plow. Suffice to say, they permit almost everything except these things that are determined to be so paradigmatically problematic that you still can't go near them. Here's the key thing, one of the key things we're going to have to focus on. Rabbi Nechemia then says, "Afilu talit, afilu tarvad, ein nitalin ela litzorach." So what I want to just play out for a minute here is, what does Rabbi Nechemia mean when he says, after permitted, even a talit and even a ladle, you cannot take unless it is litzorach. Forget my translation now, which I just did for the reason to have something to put at the end of the sentence. What do you think it means, right? Literally for a need, for a purpose, for a something. What do you think it means to restrict the moving of utensils unless it is litzorach? Yeah.
Well, we're saying that one of the things that makes us nervous about these kelim is that they could be used for melacha.
Okay.
So if we say, well, we're not doing any melacha on Shabbat, then what would be the purpose of most of these kelim? Probably nothing, or maybe something to save a life, or to eat things that are okay on Shabbat. And so in that case, you can touch them. You can move them.
Okay, so just clarify. Now, it's good. Clarify for me. When I say I can move a ladle, a soup ladle, litzorach, but not shelo litzorach.
Right.
So what does that mean? What would it look like to move a ladle litzorach as opposed to not?
So you can move a ladle to spoon to put some soup into a bowl, but you can't move a ladle to dig a hole in the dirt outside your house.
Okay, what about can I move, according to your understanding of this, can I use a ladle to move marbles from one side of the room to the other? Yes.
Well,
okay. Good. So, but let me ask you this then. Why would Rabbi Nechemia, if Rabbi Nechemia is only talking about, if Rabbi Nechemia, in your definition, as I understand it, is only worried about the person doing actual melacha with the ladle, why does he need to say that? Like, obviously you're not allowed to dig a hole on Shabbat.
So maybe it's only for the purpose that the kelim is designed for.
Okay.
A ladle isn't designed for moving marbles.
So one reading of Rabbi Nechemia, which is very a strict, limited reading, is you can only use things for their normal intended purpose. Don't think just because you're allowed, we said you're allowed to move a talit, that means you're allowed to use a talit to, like, wrap up your food to bring it from one place to another. You can use a talit to wear it. A tarvad you can use to dish out soup. But you can't use it to, like, store things in for that you don't want on the ground or something like that. Right? Meaning the only permission for touching kelim, according to Rabbi Nechemia, is there's an allowance made to use permitted kelim for the permitted purpose that they're designed for. But this definition still has Rabbi Nechemia clinging to a culture of fundamentally you don't touch stuff on Shabbat. And you certainly, according to this, can never move this. Right, for no purpose whatsoever can I move this marker on Shabbat. Because the normal purpose of this marker is to write with. And therefore, since I can't even move a ladle for its abnormal purpose, obviously I can't move this for any purpose whatsoever. Okay? That's one reading of Litzorah. The second, right, now let's sharpen your other reading, which you went too far off the deep end with, because it was too lenient, but you were getting at it, which is to use Litzorah for some legitimate purpose, as opposed to, for instance, to get it out of the way. So, Rabbi Nechemia might be saying, in a more lenient version, a ladle can be used to scoop up anything, because scooping things up is fine on Shabbat. You can even use the ladle to press some kind of button, to fish something out from under the couch, right? Where you're actively using it. But you can't, when the ladle is just sitting on the table, clear it off. Because you're not using the ladle. Again, you're not supposed to, in this more lenient version, right? Then, for instance, potentially, we don't know what Rabbi Nehemia thinks about pens in general. Maybe they're totally out. But you can imagine a more lenient version of Rabbi Nehemia that would say you can use the pen to somehow fish out something from under your couch, but you can't clear the pen off of your table. Okay? This is going to be key for what goes on in the Gemara, the different things that this may mean and what it may tell us about the conception of Shabbat. Okay? So now, let's quickly look at these exceptions, and I'm going to send you up. We got to see the Mishnah. We got to see the Mishnah, okay? The Mishnah then lays out... Yeah.
Sorry, I have another
one.
Please. One is if you really, really need to.
Litzora for some... Okay.
Good. And another is... I don't know if this is actually different, but Ein Ela to me means like it could be that thing of like you're doing it like because you like planned the way you're going to use it or something like that. Like not you don't use it at all except if you really have to, but actually you use it the way that you have to. And
you have to use it
like,
for the
not front. For fishing something out from under the couch, but for soup. I think it's just a strengthened.
Gotcha. It's a version of one, but with what how the language
like,
plays
go
into
right
it.
Ahead and use it for
right.
Purpose.
Okay. Good.
There's
good.
Sort of like the halting version of one, and the like is totally fine. Version.
Good. Okay. Very good. This is interesting. This doesn't totally play out on what we're going to see, but it's an interesting. It's an interesting read. Good. Now look at what the Mishnah does. The Mishnah says Kol HaKelim Nitalim B'Shabbat. So we're on Mishnah Shabbat 17. It's on the bottom in the Hebrew, on the top in the English. Okay? All tools can be moved on Shabbat. And now look at these examples. One can take a hammer to crush nuts, a hatchet to cut dates, a saw to grate cheese, a rake to gather up figs, a winnowing shovel or a pitchfork to give food to a child, a spindle or a shuttle to pierce something, a sewing needle to remove a splinter, or a sack maker's needle to open a door. Rabbi Yose says all tools may be moved except for the large saw and the pin of the plow, which we saw before. All tools may be moved, whether litzorech or not litzorech. Rabbi Nehemia says they can only be moved litzorech. Now, the Mishnah here on a plain reading seems to first play out what it would look like to reject Rabbi Nehemia, one way or the other, and then makes it clear to you that it's rejecting Rabbi Nehemia. Meaning what? It ends up saying, you can move things litzorech or not litzorech, we don't care about this category. And that, it would seem to be, well, let me leave it more ambiguous, okay? One of the things you have to think about is, when the Mishnah says all of these examples, and then gives the debate, are you to read the first part as an illustration of the rejection of Rabbi Nehemia? Meaning, does the Mishnah understand Rabbi Nehemia to mean this? And by permitting you to use a saw to grate cheese, it's saying, we don't follow Rabbi Nehemia. Mm-hmm. Or, does the Mishnah understand Rabbi Nehemia to mean this, in which case it's not in the first part weighing in on Rabbi Nehemia, because actually using a saw to grate cheese is to use it for something, as opposed to just clear away a saw. That question of how to read the Mishnah and whether it weighs in on Rabbi Nehemia is another key thing for when we go forward into the Gemara, okay? And what those cases mean, all right? Now, the next four things we're not going to do, because I want to get started on the Chavruta time, you will see, even though it would seem that by the time you get to the Mishnah, it says, Kol HaKelim Nitalim B'Shabbat. You can move all vessels, all utensils, all tools on Shabbat. There are these four texts, and I have bolded them, the key terms here. You'll see it's Kanim, Maklot, Glustra, and Meducha, rods, where are they in the middle? Sticks, a door bolt, and a mortar, that have restrictions on moving them. And one of the questions is, why are there still restrictions on these things? I thought we were allowed to move these on Shabbat. That's going to be one puzzle for you to think about. And then finally, there's this case, which is going to become very important, where Rav says, Talmud Bavli 124b, the last one on that second page, Rav says, moving a spade to avoid theft, mar shelo yiganev, zehu tiltul shelo letzorech ve'asur. That is moving something not litzorech and is forbidden. Now, just based on what we just saw, if someone comes along and says, such and such act is moving something shelo litzorech and is therefore forbidden, Who does that view seem to accord with? Rabbi Nechemya. Right? If you knew nothing else, you would say, Rav is ruling like Rabbi Nechemya here. Mm-hmm. You will see in the Gemara, there's a lot of people who don't like that assumption. And the way that this text gets read and reread becomes key to the discussion. All right? So what I have for you here is a worksheet, which you will do with what you like. You don't have to do it at all, but it may be a way of helping you to focus on this. We'll make some more copies. Actually, let me keep one in reserve here. Okay? You're going to encounter on the next pages, indeed, three basic positions that I want you to focus on. I have underlined Amoraic positions, people from, you know, Talmudic post-Mishnah period, and I have bolded Tannaitic sources, those sources that are from the earlier part of the rabbinic period. Okay? The main things I want you to focus on in terms of this chart are, you will see in the second paragraph, it starts, Amar Rav Yehuda, said Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda's statement is one. The second view is that of Rabbah, who appears in the first section, in the second section, in the third section, and in all three first sections. And then Rava, with an Aleph, who appears in the third section, and then also in the fourth and fifth sections on the next page. Okay? And I've laid out kind of the different things that are at stake here. If this isn't useful to you, don't bother. We'll put it together at the end. But these are sort of the categories of interpretive division that emerge in this sugya. How do these different views break down these different questions? And we'll both document that together at the end and talk about what that's significant in terms of where it takes us for a culture of Shabbat. Okay?
Right, so let's head up. You should explain TK.
To the Beit Midrash. Oh, yeah, sorry. TK, correct. I meant to say that. Thank you. Ruling like TK or Rabbi Nechemya means ruling like Tanakama or Rabbi Nechemya. And we're talking here about, in the Mishnah, there is this debate laid out between the main voice of the Mishnah that says you can move something Litzorech or Lo Litzorech, and Rabbi Nechemya says only Litzorech. And the question for Rabbi Yehuda and Rabba and Rava that I want you to think about is, do they rule like Rabbi Nechemya or don't they rule? Okay. How many people got to the end? It's smattering, not bad. Okay, good. How many people got to the end of the first page, but not to the two little things on the second page? All right, mixed. So it's okay. We'll do a piece of this together. If you got the first, even the first two paragraphs, you got a major piece of it. Okay, so if you all have your handy dandy sheets here, that will help us go through some of this. I want to just quickly talk through these three models and what they stand for and what they mean. Okay, so Rav Yehuda. Does Rav Yehuda rule like Rabbi Nechemya or the Tanakama? You have to intuit here, right? He doesn't tell you outright. Rav Yehuda says you can use only a nut hammer to crack nuts. Rabbi Nechemya, and which reading of Rabbi Nechemya?
Reading one,
right? The very restrictive reading of Rabbi Nechemya. Because if you were allowed to use it for some legitimate purpose, then even according to Rabbi Nechemya, it would be okay to take a hammer and crack nuts. Okay, so you see from the fact that Rabbi Yehuda says you can never use a hammer, a regular hammer can never be used, that's why he has to put that limitation on the Mishnah, it's clear that he deals with the very restrictive reading of Rabbi Nechemya, and that he rules like Rabbi Nechemya. Right? Now, one of the reasons that he may have ruled like Rabbi Nechemya, which we'll come back to, is all those exceptional cases. Right? That is to say, all these cases, which the first paragraph here engaged with, we'll come back to that in a second, which the first paragraph there featured a debate between Rabbi Elazar and Rabbah, the cases of the rods and the sticks and all of that stuff. That stuff being relevant in an ongoing way. You could imagine someone looking at that and saying, well, they permitted, but there's still all this stuff that you're not allowed to use. And a person could easily look at that and say, why aren't you allowed to use that? Because you're only allowed to use things for their normal intended purposes. And in all those cases, for one reason or another, those items are problematic. And I might actually conclude from that we follow Rabbi Nechemya. Now, What's the major problem with Rav Yehuda? How does Rav Yehuda have to read the Mishnah? Meaning of Mishnah Shabbat 17:2. Yeah.
He has to do some really, not shot work to make the hammer into a nut hammer.
Good. Which that one, maybe I can swallow, but...
A saw into a cheese saw.
Right, okay. And then, a kid's pitchfork, right? Or something like that, right? You get to a point where it simply is not tenable as an interpretation. It's an important example, though, particularly when reading the Amoraim. We talked about this in that group back there. Sometimes something can be a perfectly plausible position and be a totally lousy interpretation. And you're not entitled to throw out the position as ridiculous just because the interpretation is forced. Because Rabbi Yehuda, I think if you grabbed him by the collar and said, "But what do you mean? It's not a cheese saw," would have said, I know, but we don't follow that position. So I have some fealty to the Mishnah. I have to somehow read it in a way that works, but I'm really following Rabbi Nechemiah, which on its own is a totally reasonable position, which is to say, this is, by the way, what, my 4-year-old son would say if I went and picked up a marker. He'd be like, "What are you doing? Get away from that thing. You don't use this on Shabbat." And then I could start with the whole thing. Actually, I'm just moving it because I need the place and I'm going to put something else there. Right? But he would legitimately say, "Abba, why are you picking up a marker on Shabbat?" Right? So that is a sort of instinctive relationship to objects on Shabbat. You don't go near anything that is normally used for something problematic. And you only pick stuff up in general to use it for Shabbat-related activities is what Rav Yehuda represents in this debate. Those exceptional cases, you don't move a mortar, why? What are you doing moving a mortar on Shabbat? If it's got some garlic in it, maybe, okay, you have some business engaging with the garlic, but otherwise, you shouldn't be going anywhere near a mortar on Shabbat. Okay? So it's this reading of Rabbi Nechemiah. We follow it. The exceptional cases confirm that we follow Rabbi Nechemiah. The only problem is you can't really read the Mishnah. And this, then, leads to a very simple reading of the case that was at the I brought you at the end of the exceptions in C, where Rav talks about you are not allowed to take a spade and move it so it will not get stolen on Shabbat. That just becomes a straightforward ruling like Rabbi Nechemiah. Why can't you move a spade so it doesn't get stolen? What are you doing with a spade? It's for digging in the ground. And the statement may be to say, what does it mean, not even for, so it won't be stolen? Not even if you're worried it's going to be stolen. Don't give me some excuse of, I would never normally move a spade, but I don't want it to be stolen. Too bad! Can't move it. Okay, so that's that first line. And I want you to sort of have that in your head as a very powerful version of what this may look like. And in a way, it's the position that preserves a good deal of the earlier regime of that barishona, that relationship to, you don't really touch stuff on Shabbat, and the only thing that you touch are innocuous-looking things for innocuous purposes. But other than that, you don't touch stuff on Shabbat. Okay? Great. That's Rav Yehuda. Now, Rabbah, a little more complicated. Does Rabbah rule like Tana Kama or Rabbi Nechemiah, and how do you know? Yeah.
We were thinking that he was more like Tanakama.
Good.
Because the comment about a blacksmith's hammer to crush nuts, you think something normally used for a forbidden purpose may be used for a legitimate purpose. Okay, so if you're making some use out of it, maybe it's not the use that most people would automatically assume it's for. You're still using it for something to actually really be using it. Not just touching it.
Okay, good. But tell me, how do you know he's not just following reading 2 of Rabbi Nechemiah? Because what you just described was our second possibility of what he meant.
Which is pretty much exactly what I wrote down.
Okay, but go further. There is indication that he's not like Rabbi Nechemiah. He's like Tana Kama, but how do we know it? How do we know, let me put it another way. How do we know that he's not like reading 2 of Rabbi Nechemiah, but rather assumes Rabbi Nechemiah is reading 1 and rejects it. Yeah.
So when Abaye challenges him, he dismisses that opinion as being something in a Rabbi Nechemiah, therefore not challenging him.
Great. by deflecting a text by saying, that's Rabbi Nechemiah, you reveal you don't hold that position. So I want you to understand, Rabbah agrees with Rabbi Yehuda that this is what Rabbi Nechemiah means, but he rejects that. And he says, we don't follow that. In fact, we follow a view that says, you can use anything for permitted use. And how does he then read the Mishnah? What's the meaning of the Mishnah, the saw to cut cheese and all of that? It's a real saw, and why are you allowed to use it to grate cheese? It's a legitimate purpose. Basically, now, this already starts to have a very different feel, right? You can feel, we're still in a world of, we'll get to this in a second, we're a little nervous about people touching certain things on Shabbat, but you already feel the shift towards, we want to know what you're doing with the thing. Right? Rav Yehuda could care less what you're doing with that hammer. Doesn't matter if you're using it to crack nuts. You don't go near that hammer. Rabbah already wants to know, well, what are you doing with it? And if you're doing something that's legitimate, he will essentially let you move anything except those crazy things with the pin of the plow, Yatecha Machresha, and Igan Shosfina, etc., etc. Okay? All those exceptional cases. So Rabbah already is taking us to that place, and he then reads Rav's ruling on the spade now in a different way. How do you have to read that case if you don't hold like Rabbi Nechemiah? Because this is going to be the dilemma in Bavel. In Bavel, everyone is going to want to say that whatever Rav said, Rav, you know, the sort of early dominant Amora in Bavel, no one's going to throw out his ruling. So they're going to keep the ruling that you can't move a spade so it doesn't get stolen. But the problem is, if you reject Rabbi Nechemiah, you can't just say, well, that's because Rabbi Nechemiah doesn't allow you to move a spade. So now what do you have to say? Why can't you move a spade so that it not gets stolen? Great. Now getting stolen now has been shifted from what I think its original meaning is, which is, I don't care if you're going to tell me it's going to get stolen, you still can't move it. No, it's the fact that you want to move it so it won't get stolen that is the problem. And what's wrong with moving something so it won't get stolen? Why is that different from the Mishnah's case of a saw to cut cheese? It's not a functional use. This will be the distinction in later halacha between, right, and in the later passage, letzorach gufo as opposed to letzorach mekomo. Letzorach gufo is okay. To use something in order to use its object for something is all right. Letzorach mekomo, okay, so I can pick this up to fish something out from under the couch. But if this is on my table and I want it out of the way, I can't clear it off. I have no business going near clearing this off. This creates a meltdown in the Gemara because then they're like, wait a minute. According to Rabbah's understanding of Rabbi Nechemiah, how could you ever clear the table? Because once you're done with the plate, you have no business moving it anymore. Okay, resolve. All right, but you start to see the way when you start to think in these terms, and you've created the category of moving something away as its own thing. Right, Rabbi Nechemiah was just able to say, "Don't go near that thing; it's a problematic thing." And the plate, you know, so who knows how he would have defined the tzorach there. But once Rav's statement gets turned into shelo yiganev, it's a problem because you're not using it for something. That creates a whole other set of categories. Okay, so Rabbah then represents a line of the development of thinking here, where effectively what you're doing is saying, yeah, you can move anything for some kind of permitted use, but otherwise you still withdraw. So he's moved away from Rabbi Yehuda's model. There's certain kelim that are just off limits, right? There's almost nothing that is completely off limits. You can move markers, but you can only engage with kelim to get certain tasks done. If you're not trying to get a task done with it, you're in a way still feeling a bit of that older regime of what are you going to touch things on Shabbat to move things around? Shouldn't be moving stuff around on Shabbat. If you have a task to do, fine, you can grab the nearest thing and do the task with that. But that's it. Okay? Yeah?
Rabbah still seems to distinguish between the primary function and the not and secondary function. In other words, you can move the permissible object, even if you're not using it for its use. Right?
Correct.
Whereas the marker, you can only use if you have some legitimate use, and not just to move the space.
Good. Okay. So, correct. There still is a relevance to the kind of kli it is, to the kind of tool, and that seems to be derivative of what part of Rav's ruling? You are correct. That detail is produced by his reading of Rav's ruling. Which part? Shelo yiganev, that it not be stolen, produces the notion that it has to be used. What produces the notion that it matters what kind of thing it is? What kind of tool does it talk about? A spade.
Which you can't use.
Right? So that's the sense in which he inherits a part of Rav Yehuda, considering it's significant that the thing is a spade. But he focuses on only a spade you can't move so that it will not be stolen, in the sense of for its place or for some other thing. But maybe a talit or a ladle you would be able to move so it's not stolen. Right? That's reading into that detail. Now, where this really gets dramatic as a shift is then in Rava's position. Okay, Rava, for those of you who got to it, in the third section, you really see this played out. Further in section 4 in another kind of a way. Rava creates this other category which gets called Mechama Latzer, taking something out of the sun in order to get it into the shade. Or rather, putting it into the shade in order to get it out of the sun. Okay? What this means, this is a category that essentially means I'm engaging with a tool for its own purpose and its own need. Right? Roughly, the Talmud here talks about three ways of engaging with objects. One is to use them functionally to accomplish a task. The other is they're in the way. They're in the wrong place. The third is, think about putting silverware back in the drawer. You're not using it to eat. You're not using it because you need the space on the table. You're using it because you're trying to tidy things up. You want the fork back in its proper place. Right? Rava creates this category. We'll come back to this in a second. But he, too, rules like whom? Not so different from Rava. Who does he rule like? Like Tanakama, right? Already rejected Rabbi Nechemia. Okay? And tell me what Rava, for those of you who read, whoever got to the list, what does Rava forbid you to move on Shabbat? Yeah.
Only forbidding tools you're worried about, but you don't have any direct need with them.
Only forbidden tools, mechama latzel. The only thing that Rava forbids you to move on Shabbat is something that is a problematic thing in its own right, in order to take care of it. Like taking tools and moving them back into the shed, because that's where they belong. Right? Otherwise, anything that's a permitted tool, I can do whatever I want with it. I can move it to do something with it. I can move it out of the way. I can even put silverware back in the drawer. According to Rabbi, not so clear you can do that. Okay? Not so clear you should be spending your time on Shabbat cleaning up and putting silverware back in the drawer. You can, with a marker, use it to do something. You can also get it out of the way. What you can't do is put the marker back where it belongs. Now here's the thing about Rava. How did Rava, just one sec, so how did Rava get to that position based on what you saw? Try to connect, how does Rava read that position based on the debate in section 1 about whether those exceptions have any ongoing relevance and Rav's statement about the spade. I know this is a lot of computing at, 8:59 at night, but think about it.
Can you ask a question?
I'll ask it again. Rava gets to this shockingly broad permission. If you think about it, Rava permits you to basically move anything on Shabbat. And the question is, why does he carve out, have this little tiny exception of the only thing you're not allowed to move is a forbidden tool, mechama latzel, to take it out of a problematic place to put it away? How does he get to that? Yeah.
That's the only way you can deal with the spade, because the spade you're moving not to benefit from it, but and not not to reclaim the space, but to specifically get the spade into a place where it can't be stolen.
Great. And why is that the only way he can deal with the spade? What would be a thing that would potentially drive Rava to permit everything?
I'm not sure what.
Rava, because you're 100% correct. That seems to be the railroading of this case. You have to do something with this case, and it's the most limited reading. Right? He's saying, how should I read this spade so it not be stolen? A spade, which is a problematic tool, so that it not be stolen, I'm not even doing it letzorach mekomo, to use the place where it rests, I'm just engaging with it for its own sake. But the only reason you would read Rav in such a limited fashion is if you had a powerful drive to permit everything else. Yeah?
Because eventually, you know, on a visit, Nehemiah, so if you don't think, how does it be that he's wrong and Rav is right? How does that work out?
Good. So if no one agrees with Rabbi Nehemiah, and we don't want Rav to be like Rabbi Nehemiah, and I'll say it even more. What did Rabbi Elazar say? Any text that you ever see that says you can't move something is a prehistoric Neanderthal text before we came along and realized, of course you can move Kelim on Shabbat. So all other things being equal, you get the sense that Rava seems to side with that view. But he can't throw out Rav. Right? There is this ruling of Rav that says you can't move this spade. So what does he do? He whittles it down to the most narrow place he can possibly take it, which is it's a spade, and you're moving it in order to protect it, and that's why it's a problem, but everything else is okay. Now, what I would contend to you is that position, as a synthetic position, doesn't necessarily actually make a whole lot of sense. The second you're allowing people to move things for their own sake, not so clear why this kind of tool is different than a permitted tool, or to the extent that you're having problems with forbidden tools, not so clear you should be able to just move a marker from the table to get it out of your way. But what it reflects is basically the end point in a process that unfolded in the sources that we saw here, which was a dramatic shift from an earlier point in time where basically you are not supposed to touch anything, to a point where by the time you get to Rava, essentially, there's been a total shift in the culture of Shabbat where Rava, I think it's fair to say, doesn't really care about moving things and touching things on Shabbat. What Rava cares about, if you look at the end of the day, forget this example for a minute, right? This exception for a minute. Without this exception, Rava basically says, don't do malacha. Don't do forbidden stuff on Shabbat. What do I care what you move around? Just don't move it around for a problematic purpose. As long as you're moving it to clear the table or whatever it is, putting a silverware away, that's fine. This is the residue of Rav, which of course is originally seems to be the residue of Rabbi Nehemiah, of a regime of being resistant to moving things on Shabbat. And I think that shift, and then we'll just take the final comments here to close, I think that shift is a very important shift for thinking about what the essence of Shabbat is. That is to say, we end up, the black letter law in the Shulchan Aruch follows Rav. It follows this ruling, which is you can move the marker off the table in order to make space for it. And that reflects an attitude towards Shabbat that it's about don't do malacha. This is why it's possible to have a Shabbat conscious life and show up in college and be like, what are all these people talking about muktzah for? Right? It's like it's possible to conceive of Shabbat in a way as not totally engaging that. But the residues of this and any number of other things that remain, and not touching rocks and all of these pieces that never totally get phased out, reflect another conception of Shabbat, which I actually think is really powerful to think about, which is not just to think about what it means not to do work on Shabbat, but what it means to actually withdraw from God's world. And to imagine, I encourage you, in your upcoming Shabbatot, to actually think, like, go through a couple Shabbatot with a mindset of a default assumption that you won't touch anything unless you need to. And see what that kind of does as a spiritual practice of thinking through what it means to withdraw from the world as opposed to just making sure that you don't do malacha. And I think to the extent you net anything from it, you'll get a little bit of a deeper appreciation of what's at stake between Rav Yehuda and Rav. All right, there were a couple quick comments here and then we'll wrap up. Yeah.
Well, Rav is saying that you can't move the spade to avoid theft because that's lo letzarach. I don't understand how that works with the Mishnah then, with the Tanakhama, which says that things that are lo letzarach is permissible.
Good. So there's become three categories. There's letzorach, shelo letzorach. Those two are okay. And nechama latzel, which is really shelo letzorach, to the point that even the Tanakhama would not permit it. I completely agree with you. It's not the plain sense, right? That's why the better read of Rav is he's according to Rabbi Nehemiah. And that's what Rava has to do. As the Nechama Latzel is so hyper lo letzorech that even those who don't need letzorech have a problem with it. But you put your finger on exactly what the problem is with that reading. Rebecca, just want to jump in? Okay. We'll leave it there. We'll dive in Mari. And to be continued. Scott.
Thank you.